Welcome to Exploring the Wine Glass. Yep, you heard that right. I am in the process of rebranding both the podcast and the blog. You should start to see the new name soon. I have been informed by the powers that be that it should be seamless, and as a subscriber, there will be nothing you need to do. Please reach out to me at exploringthewineglass.com if you have any issues, and please follow me on all of the social media channels. If you haven't subscribed yet, now is the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Sláinte! Welcome to episode 106. Today I am back with my wine writing friends and we are discussing our top tips for wine tasting. We aren't talking about the do's and don'ts while at a winery. Instead, we are sharing our ideas on how to become more comfortable describing the wine we drink, the systematic approach we use to record tasting notes, different schools of thoughts on analysis, the three levels of wine aromatics, and what we consider a good, bad, or indifferent wine. And of course, we end with a riddle. So I hope you enjoy. Sláinte! Hey everybody, welcome to this month's Wine Writers Wrap-Up. These guys are wonderful because I totally forgot to send out the email on Friday and sent it out yesterday. And thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedules to come and join in the conversation and all of the Google technical issues that are occurring. So thank you very much. Today on Wine Writers Wrap-Up, we are talking wine tasting tips. So my thought process behind this was, I know a lot of people, and myself included, when you first start tasting wine, you know, you're nervous. You're like, oh, I don't know what that is. I don't know how to do this. I don't really know what I'm tasting. And, you know, you get intimidated if you're tasting with somebody else. And, you know, and one of the things I hate to do is, and why we don't do it on our label is I hate reading what I'm supposed to be tasting or smelling, because in my brain, once I see blueberry, oh yeah, there's blueberry. So we're going to talk about some wine tasting tips, hopefully some things that we can tell you that make it a little bit more fun and relaxing and help you to improve your palate and your aroma ability. But first, let's introduce ourselves. Debbie, I'm going to go left to right, so you're all the way to my left. Go ahead.
So I'm Debbie Giaquindo. I'm the Hudson Valley Wine Goddess. I'm a wine writer. I am owner of Kitchen 330, which is a restaurant in Stone Harbor. I'm author of Tapping the Hudson Valley, a book on traveling and visiting all the craft beverages in the Hudson Valley. I'm co-owner of Happy Bitch Wines, and I don't know if I left anything out.
Co-host of Wine for Bet Street.
Oh, yes, co-host of Wine for Bet Street with Lori. And that's probably about it, in a nutshell.
In a nutshell. And Michael?
Yeah, Michael Kelly. I'm out in California. And I write for my own website, California Wines and Wineries. I also blog on Facebook, California Wines and Winery. Those are the two main things I do.
Wonderful. And Nicole.
Hi. So I'm a wine writer, and I also work at a wine store, and I teach. And let's see what else. Oh, and I'm a co-organizer of Batonage Forum, which is a event for women in wine happening in just under a month in Napa Valley. You can find me at Nibbling Gypsy and Songs Table. Those are my two blogs. And then I also do a pairing series for Wine Spectator called 8-20.
Wonderful. And I'm your host, Lori. My husband, Michael, and I own Dracena Wines in Paso Robles. We focus in on Cabernet Franc, and we, I'm going to stop there with that, because if I keep going into what we're doing, I can't even remember all the stuff I'm doing. But yes, so welcome to Wine Writers Wrap-Up, And before we get into the actual tips, I'm going to shock everybody. And I am drinking water tonight. I am drinking water. I am actually giving my liver a little break this week because on Sunday I am heading to Cancun. And I know once I get there, it is just going to be downhill in terms of, you know, drinking. So I decided that this week was going to be a little detox time for my liver in preparation so that it can go into overtime starting next week. So what about you guys? What are you drinking?
I've got a glass of Oregon Pinot Noir from Planet Oregon.
Planet Oregon.
Yeah, where's my thing here? This is the first time I'm using my tablet. So.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, Planet Oregon. I don't know where it came from. We belong to the Oregon Pinot Noir Club, so I'm thinking it came from there. It's 2015. And I was also going to give my liver a break, having just come back from 4 days in Lodi, but then when I got the news that somebody passing, I said I have to have a glass of wine. The last trip I was on with her was Oregon. So.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing now.
And Michael, I did see wine in your hand.
Yes, for one of the few times that I always felt like I was, you guys didn't really think I drank wine. So I have a glass of Wood Family Chardonnay. They were here just recently for a winemaker's dinner. And they also, they came up, did the winemaker's dinner. They won double gold in San Francisco Chronicle in 2018 and double gold in 2019 this year.
Very nice.
For their Chardonnay.
Very nice. And Nicole, I'm sure you just like kind of rushed home. Do you have anything in your glass?
Well, I went for a run and took like a quick shower. So I'm drinking kombucha because I wasn't quite ready to start drinking wine.
All right.
I did wear a wine t-shirt since I couldn't be drinking, so I'm wearing a Tessier Femme Fatale Rosé t-shirt.
That is very cute. I love it. I love it. A little pink panther with some pink wine there. I like it.
And I didn't understand a word of it, so.
Well, it's all in the t-shirt somewhere.
Okay. Somewhere. All right. So let's get into some wine tasting tips. The first thing I thought of is when I first started drinking wine and tasting, we didn't really have a set format. We were like, oh yeah, it tastes like this, it smells like this, blah 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 blah. And then as I've started, you know, getting further into wine and you know taking other classes and things like that. What kind of developed itself, or what I adapted myself to, was the WSET tasting sheet. So I actually started with level 2 and then went to level 3. So do you guys use tasting grids, or how do you go about your tasting notes?
Well, I spent years first with the court. Master Sommeliers, and then with WSET. So to some degree, I have those ingrained in my brain. They can't help but inform like how I think about it. But I don't really use the grid specifically anymore.
Right. Well, what do you say is the difference between the quartz grid and WSET's? I don't think I've actually ever seen the quartz grid.
So to be honest, they changed it they've changed both grids since I took them. So I'm not 100% sure of the differences at this point. But one thing that I can say is that the grid for WSET, particularly once you get to level 3 and diploma, they kind of leave it mostly blank. They kind of get like sort of prompts on the side. You're supposed to kind of remember a lot of it. Whereas the grid actually the quartz grid actually like lays it out in terms of like this factor by factor.
Oh, okay.
At least that was
what it was. But did it basically follow the same general?
Fury, yeah. Right. There's some differences, but like I said, I haven't seen the more recent ones.
Michael?
So, what I really use is a template that's a WSET template, WSET template. And at the same time, I also use the one from the, and I think you were out for the Wente, for the winemaker studio.
Yes.
They have a template at Wente, the winemaker studio. And I also use one in the, my software program that I do all my management of the inventory. There's also one there, that I use. And then when I did the blind tasting for Cab Franc Day, for example, I kind of combined the three of them that would make, because if we have novice to sophisticated tasters. So depending on whether it's a blind tasting or you're just tasting the wines, I pull this out, add this, take this out, et cetera. So just, it depends on what you're trying to do and how serious the event is, I guess, the best way of saying it.
You know, what's funny is when I personally taste wine, I just go with my first initial whatever, just like everybody else, but I just write it all down. I found that when I use the taste, you know,
the grid,
the sheet, it was more like I'm looking for things and I'm like, okay, you know, pairing that I wasn't giving like my readers, a good, impression of the wine, because a lot of them are, novice. They're like, okay, they're not going to look and,
right,
tilt it on the side and look at the hue of the color. But I note all that. And it's just, how I put it out. And it's funny because in my book, I did put a form in the back of my book for tastings for when people would go,
I think the grid is a good idea as a guideline type thing. But I know what you're saying, Debbie, because I think the purpose of writing tasting notes is really so somebody who didn't taste it knows what the heck it tastes like, or that you can remember it years from, right?
Right.
I think I wrote better tasting notes before I went through the program and went to that grid.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think too, because I basically kind of do something similar to what you do, Debbie. I just kind of write my own notes. I think what's good about the grid is that it forces you, when you're learning, to sort of think about it in a specific format or structure. However, you're tasting under those circumstances for the purposes of a test, and everybody's supposed to have the same language, so you're supposed to kind of fit your descriptions sort of into the language of that test.
Right.
So it doesn't allow for much, extra description or poetry or, things that will make a tasting note really come alive and be more evocative, I think. So I think when you're writing to try to describe to somebody else, I can, if you're sticking to the grid too much, you're kind of holding back.
It's kind of a left brain, right brain. You want to have some basic framework, but then I was at a tasting today with the winemaker owner up in Murphy's today, and I drank his Chardonnay from Russian River that he gets the grapes from, and he was telling me how good it was, and I said, boy, it tastes like a candied apple. And I said, I haven't had a candied apple in 55 years, but it stuck in my brain that there was a candied apple kind of a flavor that came across, but that's not in a guide or a grid. So you kind of just have to kind of use your creative side and your analytical side in combination, I think.
Right. I get those things. I don't understand the people who write tasting notes that I'm like, I have no clue what that is. The underside of the fifth element of the, is that good? Is that bad? I don't know what that is. There are some people who write tasting notes. I read them to Mike and I'm like, so is this a good wine or a bad wine? I don't know if they like it or they don't like it.
they go look in all the 20 different adjectives that they use to
describe. Right. So in that respect, I think if you're just getting into tasting, I think it's really nice to have that grid. Because like you said, Nicole, it pigeonholes you, but it guides you to look for specific things. And then once you can get that grid somewhat in your head of going through that process, then Michael, like you were saying, the right side, you can now start to elaborate and be a little bit more creative. But I do think we can be, some people, me too, could be overly creative when trying to write. You know, you're trying to express something, but really you have to keep in mind that the basis is so somebody knows what the wine tastes like.
Yeah. And so I do basically a wine review every other day, and I'm not trying to make this thing War and Peace. I'm just trying to give them, what does it look like? What does it smell like? What does it taste like? You know, and a couple of adjectives in each of those three categories, and then boom, it goes out to everybody and their brother, you know?
Right.
So you don't want to get, you see some winemaker's notes, and it's, I copy and paste, and it fills up the whole entry.
Oh, so everybody's palate is different?
Right.
So we all experience, from the same wine, we can experience different nuances. So, you know, when I taste, and it's something I'm going to write about, you know, if I like it, if I'm wowed, if I'm totally wowed by it, I will tell them. Because I'm really, you know, wowed by it. If there's something I don't care for, like I don't care for like really sweet wines, I will say, you know, if you like this type of wine, you will definitely like this.
Right.
You know, because not everything is my cup of tea, and not everything is their cup of tea. But I think they have to know there's got to be something in there so that they can make a educated decision for themselves whether or not they want to purchase that.
I think that's a really good point. When I teach classes from time to time, I tend to say that it's actually kind of both subjective and objective when you're tasting. because in some ways, like there's certain flavor compounds that will be in certain types of wine, like pyrazines and Cabernet Franc. But how that sort of translates to us, like what the flavors of a wine might be, is going to come across a little bit different to everybody, or everybody might be a little bit more sensitive to one type of flavor or another. But that said, like my raspberry could be somebody else's strawberry, but it's still the fruit camp. You know, when you're talking about certain things, you just have to allow for some leeway.
Right. And that, you know, when you go to the science of it, what I taste, I can take a bite of a raspberry and you can take a bite of that same exact raspberry and your brain is interpreting that flavor differently because that's just how chemistry is in our brains, right? So everybody's palate, I mean, really everybody's palate is different. And it's really your brain interpreting something. And I think that some people take so much concern over the tasting notes, but like even colors, you know, what's the difference between a dark ruby and a garnet or, you know, a light garnet or, you know what I mean? Like ruby versus what?
I said, well, that one I have an answer for.
Oh, do you?
According to the test.
Right.
Then, anyway.
No, right. But according to the test, there's a very definition, you know, it's, you know, the purple with the red or, you know, but my eyes are seeing that differently than your eyes are seeing that, you know? And I don't know, does it really matter that much? Like does it matter that much if that color is that slightly different? I guess is what.
I think it only matters. Like it could be helpful in the context of a test if you're blind tasting something, because it might give you a clue.
Right.
It might not, and it's not going to really change your enjoyment of the wine in an everyday context at all.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't think you need to be, people who are new to tasting need to be so stressed over, ooh, is this garnet or is this, you know, ruby or, you know, I think purple is a piece of cake, purple, you know.
But I think the description of the color, you can lead your readers in a certain direction. So the other day I used the word royal purple. Well, that means that must be a good wine, you know, a royal purple as opposed to a raunchy purple.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the adjective also, I mean, relative to how you're describing it, can, this is a raunchy purple color. Well, no one's going to read anything beyond that. So if you put royal purple color, people go, well, I don't really know what royal purple is, but that sounds like I want to keep reading. You know?
Yeah, it definitely sounds much better than raunchy.
Yeah.
All right, let's, so we kind of talked about, as I brought up by sheer accident, the first thing is looking at it. The next thing is basically sniffing it, smelling the aromas. And as you smell the aromas, you know, we have, by the tasting grid, we have three levels of aromas, right? We have the primary, the secondary, and the tertiary. I personally find them blending together. Like, I never really, like, think about which is primary, secondary, and tertiary, except for the test. But what about you guys? How do you go about those aromas?
Well, I mean, agreed. Like, I think when you're talking to most people aren't thinking about it in those terms. So what I liked, and I also think, I think a couple of people brought up earlier, that sometimes these terms can be so intimidating, and wine is already so intimidating. So I kind of like to give people different contexts to think of these things in. So since I had a culinary background before I had a wine background, I kind of think of it one way, is to think about it as, like, instead of thinking about it as wine, think about it as, like, sauce or soup. It's like when you're already kind of, I think a lot of us are already used to thinking about those things in terms of, like, ooh, what's that herb in there? What do you think that is? Is that oregano? Is that thyme? And I feel like wine tasting is, like, really similar to that. So I think putting it in a different context, is a good thing. And then instead of the primary, tertiary, the secondary, tertiary characteristics, another sort of mental sort of game I like to tell people to play is sort of take a walk around your kitchen. Like first look at the produce, see what's in the produce section, and then what fruits, what vegetables, what condition is that fruit or vegetable in, and then take a look at your spice count. See if any of those things in your mind. And then maybe take a walk outside and see if you're getting anything, you know, foresty.
That's a good tip.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really is.
Yeah. And I just want to backtrack a little bit for those who are watching or listening who don't know what those are. Primary characteristics would be actually from the grape itself. Secondary is what the winemaker does to it, you know, the oak or something like that. And then the tertiary is actually the aging of it. You know, the flavors that, or the aromas, well, there could be flavors too, but the aromas that you get because of the aging of it. So those are the three basic levels. So any other tips, Debbie, Michael?
When I taste, or, you know, and I'm doing the aromas, I you know, it, yes, they all go together as one, but in the back of my mind, I know where they come from. You know what I mean? But I don't express that in what I write, because I think that just complicates things.
And rather than going primary, secondary, tertiary, I just try to do a fundamental, okay, what's the dominant, and then what are the underlying?
Right.
And you know, you can smell this and go, oh, it's strawberry or cherry or whatever. And you put that down, and then you say, now what else is in there? What am I really tasting? And then try to pick out one or two things that are really unique to that particular wine. And that way you've got a little bit of underlying, whether it's tobacco or leather, and how it came about, whether it's secondary, tertiary, it's not so much, but you're trying to describe what that latent or lingering taste is.
Right. And I think, what you alluded to is actually a very good tip, is, you know, you have to keep coming back to it. Because 90, in my opinion, I guess, like the first thing that you're going to get is, hope, you know, is that fruit that's in, you know, you're hoping anyway, fruit that's in there. And then you kind of have to go, okay, well, this is this. Now let me see what's after the fruit, right? After the fruit, there's something else there. And then if it is a complex wine, if it's a well-balanced, you know, a nice complexity to that wine, all right, now there's something else coming. And I think that each time you go back to it, you're, you know, you can sense a little bit more of it. So.
And I have a standard thing that you take three separate sips.
Okay.
You know, you do one sip, and I mean, I had a Portuguese wine last night at a friend's house, and the first sip, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the worst wine I've ever tasted. The second sip, it was a little bit more characteristic, and the third sip, I go, I like it. You know, so it was kind of a, but you can't simply go on one sip or, so I try to, every wine I taste, I do three sips.
Well, I agree with you, Mike, because when I do the tasting, especially if it's a white wine, and, you know, all wines, you know, the initial drink or sip, whatever you want to call it, the initial evaluation. And then as time goes on, the wine changes in your glass. The white wine will warm up, and then new flavors and aromas will become more apparent. And the same thing, you know, sometimes with a red. So, you know, it's important to have those different steps. When I was in Lodi last week, we tasted a barrel sample of an oak Chardonnay. And I think it was Harney Lane.
Harney Lane.
And my first taste, it was just real rough on the finish. Like, the wine needed some finishing. It was just a little unbalanced on the finish. But then as the lunch wore on and I tasted at different intervals, all of a sudden the finish wasn't as bad as it was the first sip that I had.
Right.
So,
I mean, and that speaks to as well just how the wine can evolve over time.
Yep.
Glass with air. It's a very good point.
And
one more.
Oh, go ahead, Nicole.
One more tip I wanted to offer up at a bakery where I work. Sometimes they do blind tasting classes every Monday. They've simplified in terms of how to think about it even further. They just say give three fruit aromas, three non-fruit aromas, and just start there. Going back to the, you know, the type.
Right. Although, unfortunately, some wines you can't get three and three, but yeah.
I had one of those today.
Oh. Yeah, and temperature is a biggie. Temperature is a huge, huge factor of how a wine tastes. Again, you know, the classes tell you to serve them at certain temperatures, blah, blah. But the wine does definitely change depending on what temperature you are serving it at. You know, I know people, and I'm not saying don't do it, but like the red wines, you know, they're drinking a cab or something, a high tannin wine, and they're serving it like ice cold. And, you know, you taste it and you're like, you know, there's just bitter, there's just tannin.
I also think a lot of white wines are served too cold. Now, I'll be the first to admit, I like, especially in the hot heat of the summer, I like a nice, cold white wine, but I also know it mutes out the flavors and the aromas.
Right.
And I really appreciate, as it warms up, you know, what I get in it.
Right. And I think that's a fun experiment for somebody who is new to tasting. new to wine to do is to take a wine and, you know, go ahead, shove it in the refrigerator and pull it out and drink, you know, Michael, take your first sip at as soon as it comes out of the refrigerator, take your second sip like 15 minutes later and a half an hour later and see how that evolves. And I think that that can really train your palate to find new things because they're not there when it's really cold. And, you know, as it warms up, it evolves and it changes. So.
And when I take a red wine out of the cellar, we have at least two dinners a week that are formal wine pairing dinners. And we'll go ahead and I'll take the wine out a minimum of 2.5 hours out of the cellar, which is 55 degrees. And these wines have typically aged anywhere from 8 to 12 years, pull them out, decant them, filter them, and then put it back in the bottle and just let it warm up slowly. And I think you get a lot, so much more out of that red wine. Debbie,
by the way, Mike has a killer wine cellar.
Oh.
Yeah.
I saw pictures. I saw the inventory.
I brought the inventory book down for her to see.
How many pages is that? Is that a Game of Thrones book?
Yes.
It's about 65 pages.
Very nice. I will say using the phone makes it a lot lighter to carry. And now a word from our sponsor. Exploring the Wine Glass is brought to you by Dracena Wines. Dracena Wines is an artisan winery located in Paso Robles, California. They have been producing wine since 2013. Their first vintage began with one wine, their classic Cabernet Franc, which received a 91 in Wine Enthusiast. Since then, they have increased production, received several accolades, including double gold medals in the San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition, and consistent 90-plus ratings. In addition to their classic Cabernet Franc, they now produce a single vineyard, single clone reserve Cabernet Franc, and a rosé of Syrah. Although they've increased production every year, they continue to sell out each vintage. Find out more about Dracena Wines and their award-winning wines at DracenaWines.com and let them help turn your moments into great memories. When you are tasting, what do you look for in terms of, for if you're going to say the wine is balanced or the wine is harmonious, what do these terms mean to you and how can you explain those terms to a new taster?
So for me, I'll just jump in. For me, a lot of it has to do with the structure, actually. So by structure, I mean acid, tannin, body, tannin in the case of reds, and in the case of some white wines, sweetness. And you just need... I always think of it kind of as a trend, particularly like with red, like acid body and kind of like a triangle.
Right.
So everything has to be kind of standing up kind of right. So like,
yep.
In certain cases, like if you have a wine that has a lot of tannin and a lot of body, but not enough acid, it kind of just falls flat. And it just kind of sits in your mouth in this kind of weighty, kind of not very pleasant way. So that to me is unbalanced. And then in addition, that you're looking for flavors to just be sort of harmoniously playing together. Nothing too black.
Right. Not one thing popping out over here and then something else popping up over there. You said triangle, you know, that's so much more simpler. I'm like, it's a Jenga game, you know, like if the acid is just sticking out too much or the tannin is sticking out, the Jenga just falls over.
I actually really like that.
Yes, there's a bottle and I've put it, to me, it's the best label. Not necessarily the best wine. It's very good wine, but it's the best label. And it's a tightrope walker. with the long balance and the wine. If you look it up later, it's called Young Inglewood, and that's that. He's just a little stick figure with a rope, and he's got the balancing bar, and it's like everything just seems to, you know, it's the acid, the fruit, the tannins, the nothing is overweighing, because if it overweighs, it's going to fall off the tightrope. And I just think that's just indicative of when I look at it, when I taste a wine, if, you know, am I like, whoa, the acid's way over here and I fall off, or it's the fruit so forward that it tastes like jam. I mean, that's how the balance goes.
I think that everything needs to come together to be happy, to come in and make your palate sing, you know, oh, this is really good. If your palate is zinging and zagging and, you know, doing all the different directions, it's not coming together, and there's something not quite right with that. And it doesn't necessarily, you know, like there's not a set level of acid or a set level of tannin, because, you know, you can have, or sweetness, and you can have a seriously sweet wine, but if the acid is there, you're not tasting that sweetness. It's not overpowering.
Exactly.
I think I learned that lesson years ago. I was asked to do a tasting. I was given samples of Rieslings from the Finger Lakes. And when we pulled out the bottles of wine, one of them, the sugar level, the residual, was so high. And I was like, oh my God, I was like dreading having to taste this wine. And, you know, Mike was like, I'm not even touching this. I'm not touching this because it's just going to be too sweet. But the acidity level in that wine was so perfect for that residual sugar level that it was the best Riesling we had. Like, it really cut through that sweetness, and it was a very pleasant wine. And I think that was the first time that I was like, you know, smacked in the face of, wow, you know, you can't really always go by, you know, what that residual is. You've got to really take that whole picture in.
Situation at New York Thinks New York with some wines that I tasted that I was like, oh, 4%, this is going to, you know.
Yeah.
I was just like, it was so acidic that it needed that sugar just to balance it out so it would be palatable.
I have to agree there. Like, I think a lot of people are so concerned about something not being, that a wine shouldn't be sweet, but you can actually absolutely have had that experience of like wine that it's almost so dry and acidic that it feels that if you add a little more sweetness in there, it actually balances the whole thing out, makes the whole thing feel smoother.
Yeah.
Whereas like a Riesling that's so steely that, or Conversion or whatever, that like that's so steely that it actually feels out of balance
the other way. Lacking. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or a puckering Sauv Blanc from Marlborough, New Zealand, or something. You know, it's so citrusy. It's like it's throwing you too far the other direction.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's coming from an acid head. There are, you can be out of control with the acid. It can be. yeah. All right, Michael, you kind of talked a little bit about it in terms of blind tasting. I'm pretty sure all of us have done blind tastings. Right.
Oh yeah.
All right.
We had a bunch of them over the last week.
I think it is so much fun to do a blind tasting. But what would you say is the first thing? And Nicole, we kind of talked a little bit about what's your thought process when you're doing a blind tasting? What are some giveaways for somebody? I mean, we might be doing it as a blind tasting, but a new taster can be looking at it. What are some of the giveaways that you use in a blind tasting to help you say what that wine is?
So, well, first I kind of want to say it's like, it seems like a parlor trick, but it's really just process of elimination when you're doing it correctly. I'm completely out of practice. kind of do that by sort of putting things into camps. First, like we kind of talked about structure, maybe you use the color, like we talked about, and that sort of helps you sort things into camps. But in terms of flavors, some that are giveaways, we talked about parazines, or I mentioned parazines earlier, that give things like a sort of green or bell pepper note. Once you get that in a red, it's like you have like three options.
Right.
Cat rock. And then from there, you might use the structure to sort of help you sort further. And then if you get it in a white, it's sod block. And that's it. And you pretty much know that. If you get petrol, which is such a weird thing, one of those like weird things that blind people say, but if you get like kind of a gasoline smell, that's, you know, you have Riesling. And if you get like super flat floral notes in a white wine that are like sort of over the top floral, you have like a, that's another camp of like
Vertimeter.
Like Tarantas and maybe Albarino. And then from there, again, you sort based on structure. And then there's a bunch of things, but yeah.
All right. And in terms of color, you know, there's certain grapes that you know provide a deeper color. You know, Petite Syrah is deep, you know. Pinot is more on, for the majority of them, more on the lighter color. You know, so you can help break down what you're tasting by that grape color intensity.
One kind of fun one to pay attention for along those lines is that Malbec will tend to have this like violet pink rim a lot of the time. Like sometimes like it'll just like almost be a like bright purple pink. And it'll always have like a hint of that. Kind of fun to see.
Oh, you know, I'm going to have to start, you know, Malbec World Day is the 17th, so I've got lots of Malbec here. I'll have to start looking at that.
Okay. Well, maybe I can chime in one thing about that, about when you're doing the blind tastings. One of the things is you have to know your audience when you do blind tastings, because we moved up to a new area 2.5 years ago, totally different area of California. And I did a blind tasting. I had wines that were typical Cab Francs, or excuse me, typical Cabernet Sauvignons from the area, and they were all in the $100 to $200 range. But I threw in a local wine, a $28 local wine. Well, and I did a blind tasting. These are people I really just had met recently. And guess what? The $28 wine was the favorite because of a house palate.
Oh.
And you have to get out of yourself with a house palate. And I'm doing a tasting the end of this month for the Sierra Foothill competition. And again, and it's a thing where your mind and your taste buds are arm wrestling with each other because it's what do you like versus what is the characteristic of a classical wine to drink? And so I think wine tasting is one of the blind wine tasting is one of the more difficult things because you can't rate it based upon whether you like it. Is it, you rate it, and that's Debbie, Lori, that's what we did with the Cab Franc Day. We did an objective test and we did a subjective so that you could, that way they didn't go away schizophrenic at the end of the evening.
Right. And I think that if you're doing a wine judging a competition, it's more of a, it's like an AKC dog show, you know, or, you know, you're comparing to a standard. This is what I'm tasting. This is what a Cab Franc is supposed to taste like if it's a new world. This is what a Cab Franc is supposed to taste like if it's an old world. So it's more like, you know, that's how I think of it, is an AKC dog show. You've got a standard, and how does that wine stand up to that standard? And I think that's how a competition is done in terms of getting your rating. But absolutely true with the house palate. And, you know, that's a problem with winemakers too. If they're only drinking their own wines, they don't know, they're never going to know if their wine is bad because,
that's right.
Because they're just drinking their own wine. You have to drink other people's wines in order to know what is wrong with yours or what's good in yours.
Good about yours. Yeah.
Right. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was how the environment can truly affect how you, what you are tasting and how you are tasting. So what should you be, what can we tell people in terms of when they're tasting to really taste, not just to enjoy, because that's a whole other ballgame, but when you're tasting to taste, what are some things that you should be, I guess, environment you should be in or environment that you shouldn't be in?
So can I, I'll speak up on my pet peeve.
Sure.
Woman's perfume.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
That
or men's cologne. Or men's cologne.
I'll give you a little bit, but it's mostly women that come into these tasting rooms and just overpower the whole room with perfume. And right. It's just like, you know, can you go stand? I mean, I got my dog outside. You go stand outside with the dog. <you know? laughs> It's that bad. It really is bad. And then the other thing is, I think tasting the wine, there's obviously something to go with cheeses or foods and some things of that sort. But also, I think music, and I just saw an article recently about music affecting your tasting. And, you know, I think to me there's a certain mood you want to be in when you taste the wine as opposed to, you know, and again, I don't listen to rap, but I use that, you know, or a Cinco de Mayo music or right. something. I mean, you just got to have the wine that seems, you have to have the right soothing music to enjoy the wine at the same time.
I did read that article. I thought it was a interesting article because it was not rap. I forget what music they had said won. Oh, it was hip hop. Hip hop won. You know, the wine tasted the best when people were drinking, when they were listening to hip hop. But I'm talking more along the lines of, I'm sitting down and I'm going to taste this wine and I want to get the best experience for myself tasting the wine, to learn how to taste it. What are some tips of what the person should do? Like, I'm sitting in my house, so I don't have to worry about those stinky women coming in.
Oh, okay. Your environment being your house environment.
Yes, yes. So what should they be tasting in? What should they be tasting around? Although the music does work. The music does work in your house too.
So I just wanted to jump in because, like, I was laughing to myself, Michael's comment that, like, because I used to wear perfume all the time, and then about when I started my journey into wine, they kind of all got put up on the shelves, and then I have this like whole drawer full of perfume I never even think to use anymore. So it's kind of funny, but yeah, like, but you don't want to hurt yourself and change the environment too much. If you're tasting at home and try to create ideal scenarios, I think that the perfume thing is a good point. Not just in like what you're wearing, but you don't want to have be in a room that has a lot of like air fresheners or something like that going on, because it's going to change your senses in the same way. I think you ideally want to be in natural light or good lighting so that you can see the wine. That's ideal, but you know, you have to make do in lots of different scenarios. Sort of be in a section where you can kind of concentrate and be with the wine, calm. but I think that's very, to your point earlier, Debbie, I think that's very different than the context in which one enjoys a wine, because if you're for true enjoyment, I feel like it's convivial, you're out, you're enjoying.
Right.
And then the
dog is jumping on you, you know.
And then I think this, under the right circumstances, the simplest of wines can be magical. Mm-hmm. you know, if you're with friends or night out, good meal. I think if you're going to be eating, if you want to have something to snack on, keep it very neutral. So like water crackers or simple bread, because you don't want to change your palate.
Right.
If you're trying to pay attention and learn.
Right. And I think that's a huge tip, because people are always, you know, I'm going to taste this wine. If you're going to sit down to learn how to taste, I don't think you can have food, you know, I mean, other than that piece of bread, to cleanse your palate, you know, in between or whatever. Because as we know, the food changes the way the wine tastes. And, you know, I think you're just adding to that confusion in your brain if you're adding the food component to it. I think it's important to sit down, and if you're really trying to learn how to taste, to focus in on the taste. And yes, if I'm gonna be drinking the wine to enjoy the wine, that's a whole other ball game. I always recommend having a white sheet of paper with them, because that's the easiest way to see the actual color of it. You know, and if you are talking about, is it a light or a medium or a dark, I'm big into just shoving my hand behind it, or if there's writing on the paper, shoving the paper behind it and seeing how well you can see through it.
It's through the glass. Yeah.
Right. But I think in simplest terms, good light, right. I do the white, tell them the white paper. And then I have a little trick to help people with flavors. I use jelly beans. I always tell people to go out and buy jelly beans. And Jelly Belly should like pay me for this, because I send so many people to Jelly Bellies. But for you to learn what a pineapple tastes like, or what, you know, a lime tastes like, you can go to Whole Foods and spend a heck of a lot of money and buying and smelling all those things. Yeah. But jelly beans, Jelly Bellies are awesome, I think, for that. You know, you want to know what a tangerine tastes like, you grab a tangerine Jelly Belly and you taste it, and then you can see it, you know. So that's my little trick for people.
To kind of add on to that, I have also spent a lot of time when you're moving into those other flavor camps, like spices, herbs. I've just like stood in front of my spice rack and like sat there smelling things, like to see how it kind of, how things differentiate from each other.
Mm-hmm.
My husband always makes fun of me because when I'm smelling to take a note, I'll like kind of move my head around and put like different nostrils in the glass, because I get different scents when I sort of out of like one nose and the other. One nostril and the other. I don't know.
Yeah.
I've heard of left brain, right brain. I don't know about left nostril, right nostril.
If you take yoga, they would agree with you and explain. They would say yes, absolutely. But I was watching a video on I think it was for Scotch. Might have been for Scotch. It was a spirit of some sort. And there was a gentleman explaining how you taste this spirit, and that he said exactly the same thing. He's like, you take it and you stick your nose in this way. And you smell it, and then it was kind of funny, because he's like, he goes, hello, yes, and he's talking to it, you know, and then he takes it away, and he's like, how are you today, you know, but he said the same thing, go from left to right or right to left.
So maybe I'm not crazy.
You are not crazy, and yoga does, when you're in a yoga class that does the breathing, they have you breathe through the right nostril and then the left nostril and all of that stuff. So there's something there.
Well, you guys are on a different level than I am. I'm a two nostril the same.
I do. Well, I guess I can't even do two nostrils, because I have such a deviated septum that nothing goes through the left side anyway. So I just put the nose in there, and what is but that is you're not crazy.
One last thing on the environment. I think one of the key things is it's just like writing. It comes when it comes. Mm-hmm. You can't say, okay, today at 5 o'clock I'm going to taste Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa. And you go, and then you're tasting because you set it on your time schedule to do that. As opposed to, hey, it's 11 p.m. and I want another bottle out of the cellar, and I should, and then you really are, you've got to. There's a subjective mindset that comes at the right time to do writing and to do tasting, as opposed to saying, okay, for the next 20 days, I'm going to taste 20 different wines.
Right.
And it's like, well, at some point you're going through a have to as opposed to a want to.
Right. Right.
Enjoy. So your mind subjectively has to be open and to the experience as opposed to just getting a task done.
Correct. Correct.
And then I also like to tell people, because I think, again, as we know, people are very intimidated to offer things up, and both in terms of, they feel like they're going to be wrong somehow, but two, I understand it's, very difficult. It's like learning a new language, I think, and you're sort of when you're first starting out, you really have to sort of connect what's going on in here to what's going on in here to some kind of association. And at first that feels very much like learning a new language to me, in the beginning of okay, well, what is the word for this thing that I am experiencing right now?
Right. I think when you first start, it's very disconnected. You're building those blocks, where as you get more practice, it's a little smoother ride.
Yeah. Right. So I think it's just, in that case, it's just a matter of patience.
Right. And I think the number one tip ever of learning how to taste and become comfortable tasting is to just keep tasting.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep tasting. Always, don't give up. Just keep going and going. And, eventually one day you're going to be like, oh, yeah, I got that right off the bat without even having to think about it,
So, and to that, just add one last little. When somebody's a neophyte coming in to taste wines for the first time, friends or, golf buddies or whatever, I give them a Sauvignon Blanc and I give them a Merlot. Just a glass of, and what's the difference? Well, they're very different. Well, so why are they different? And we just kind of have that conversation. And that's kind of a golfing 19th hole conversation. But, it's an informal tasting, but it's kind of like, well, I never knew that was so different. I knew there was white wine, red wine, but I didn't really know. So I try to give people, when they want to learn a little bit about tasting wines and doing tastings, is go to the far extremes. And then they go, well, this is smooth and round. This one's got kind of a bitter citrus. And I go, good, you got it. You made your first step, your first connection, and just kind of, and then you go, okay, now next week we're going to do Merlot and a Cabernet. And now you have to figure out what the difference is. You kind of start getting it closer and closer so that they can differentiate.
And to that point, too, I think it's much, much easier if you are trying to learn, it's kind of nice, as you say, to have, two things next to each other. Because then, even if you don't have the words for what something tastes like right away, at least you have a comparison that you can make.
Right.
That's very helpful. And then, to your point, Debbie, the nice thing about, when you just, you just have to keep tasting, well, that's fun. So,
right. Right. Yeah. It never hurts to have to open another bottle. It doesn't hurt to do that. Yeah. So any final tips before we get to my favorite part?
I think we just did it.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. Get the paper ready.
All right. We lost Debbie. So we're down to just the two of you. So, She's running to get a pen. Okay, here we go. Alive without breath, as cold as death, never thirsty, ever drinking, all in mail, never clinking. And the mail is M-A-I-L. So, alive without breath, as cold as death, never thirsty, ever drinking, all in mail, never clinking.
Always in mail?
Mail. It's M-A-I-L. Alive without breath, as cold as death, never thirsty, ever drinking, all in mail, never clinking.
Sponge? A stamp?
No, yeah, see, the mail, M-A-I-L, is going to throw that off, because that's not how I thought you spelt it, but I'm not going to go with the spelling thing. It's not M-A-L-E. It's armor is what they're talking about. I didn't think that's how you spelt I didn't think that's how you spelt mail for armor.
Okay.
I thought this was a tough one, but the mail, think armor without clinking.
All right. Well, I usually have an idea. This one, I think I'm lost.
Nicole, any guess?
No, I've gone different directions with each couplet, but like,
right. So it's alive, but it doesn't breathe because it doesn't have the air. As cold as death, because it's not a warm blooded. Never thirsty, ever drinking.
Oh. So,
a root?
No, but that's kind of a good answer. Never thirsty, ever drinking. It actually gets its... It actually is always taking water in, and that's how it gets its oxygen. And then...
Is it a shark?
Kind... It's a fish.
Okay.
A fish, right? So the armor is the scales. So
okay.
That was a tough one.
That was harsh.
That was a tough one. But yeah.
I kind of led me there.
I led you. I lead my students to where they need to go. Anyways, well, we lost Debbie, so we can't say her final thing, but Debbie is at hvwinegoddess.com, and she is hvwinegoddess on the social media channels, and we are having our wine dinner at her Kitchen 330 on the 26th. We are officially sold out, and we have a waiting list, so you can head over there to get put on the wait list. But Michael, what about you? What's your final get to know you?
The Sierra Foothill wine competition is going to happen on April 26th, and there's 5 ABAs involved in it from El Dorado, Placerville, Amador, Calaveras, and Tuolumne. So that will happen on April 26th, and looking forward to that doing that again this year.
Awesome. And Nicole?
So I think my focus for the next month is going to be Batonage Forum, which I mentioned at the beginning. It's a women in wine conference, although everybody is welcome, all genders, everyone. It's happening in Napa on May 4th, and you can go to batonageforum.com. And then you can find me at Nibbly Gypsy and at the Sans Table on Instagram.
Awesome. And and Nicole, we do need to talk, because I would love to be able to get that down if, you know, see if we can do something with that in Paso, because it would be
yeah.
So sometime in the future, when that goes, when we start getting, when actually I'm there more often would be nice. Anyways, and I'm Lori. Thank you for joining in. I can be found everywhere on social media at Dracena Wines, and I actually did just start a second Instagram because, you know, why not? But the second Instagram is called Exploring the Wine Glass. And that is really more focusing in on things like this that are non-winery related, more wine education and wine samples and things like that. So if you haven't followed me on Instagram at Exploring the Wine Glass, please head over and click.
I've been enjoying your new feed for sure.
Thank you. Thank you. So anyways, well, thank you very much. Have a great night. And thank you again for joining on such short notice. You guys are awesome.
All right. Good. See you later. Bye.
Bye.
Good luck.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I am also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. I'm on all the common aggregators. Sláinte.